And then we'll hear a presentation by Senator Peterson, if he's here, on his bill, and then take up whether or not the commission wants to make any recommendations on some issues that we've spent time on in the last couple months. So Ms. Olson, who's usually been at my side, has a way on a family matter. And so we will get started. There is somebody in the audience taking minutes that wasn't interested in sitting at the table with us. So, Mr. Gehring.
All right, Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Matt Gehring from the House Research Department. The content I have for you today, you should have a set of the slides in your packet, and I'll try to go through fairly efficiently. There's a lot of content in there, but I know you have a lot of other things on the agenda today, so I'll go as quickly as possible. So far in the Commission's work, what you've done is hear a lot of specifics about particular subject areas. So you've had presentations on education data, lots of law enforcement data, bulk driver's license data and health records and other issues. The presentation today that I have for you is more of a step back to look at sort of a 10,000-foot level of how data practices works. So what I'm going to do is I'll walk through really quickly an overview of how Chapter 13 works, just to give you kind of a refresher and kind of set the table for some of the issues I'll be talking about related to other states. I'll do a quick overview of how the Federal Freedom of Information Act works. Then I'll walk through some of the structures in other states related to commissions, some timeliness issues, fees issues, and some other practices that states have that are a little bit different than the way that Chapter 13 works here in Minnesota. So feel free to ask questions as we go through, and I can take them if you have them. Otherwise, I'll just run through the content pretty quickly. So we'll start with Chapter 13. I know you all kind of know all of this, but again, just for a sort of quick refresher, Minnesota Government Data Practices Act was first enacted in 1979 and includes the presumption that all data is public unless explicitly classified otherwise. Classifications for data can be either contained in statute or by temporary classification. The Data Practices Act applies to state agencies, statewide systems, and political subdivisions. It does not apply to the legislature, to the judicial branch, and certain other entities, including non-metro townships. It does include data held by certain government contractors and other organizations that have sort of a quasi-public function, and the specific application of the act is defined in Chapter 13. As I said, the basic presumption of the Data Practices Act is all data is public unless classified otherwise. There are four classifications of data if the data are not public, and you can see them on the chart here. So private data is data on an individual, natural person. If data is classified as private in Chapter 13, it is accessible to the data subject and to government employees with authorized access. But it's not accessible to the general public. Confidential data is data on an individual natural person which is not available to an individual subject of the data, but is available to authorized government employees and not available to the general public. Generally, confidential data consists of law enforcement type data and other data that have particular security interests. There are also two classifications of data that are data that are not on individual natural persons, and those classifications are non-public and protected non-public, and they have the same structure. Non-public data is accessible to the subject of that data, or protected non-public is not accessible to the subject of that data. When a person is making a request for access in Minnesota, they must make their request specifically to the government entity that holds the data. The requester is not required to provide identification or a purpose for accessing the public data. They just need to ask specifically for a piece of data that the government holds. A person can't ask a government entity to create data for them, and they can't ask for data in a format that isn't already held, that isn't a format that's already held by the agency itself. Requests can be to inspect a piece of data. Inspection means that you go to the agency's office and actually look at the data, but don't take any pieces of paper with you. Or a person can also ask to receive copies of the data. There's a basic fee structure in statute for what can be charged when a person is asking for copies of data. If you're the individual subject of a piece of data, you can be charged the actual costs for making and certifying the copies by the government entity. If you're a member of the general public or not the subject of the data, the entity can charge you 25 cents per page, up to 100 pages of black and white copies, and anything more than 100 pages of black and white copies, you can be charged the actual cost of making and providing the copies. There's no specific response time in Chapter 13 for government entities to respond to a request. Generally, the principle in Chapter 13 is that entities have to respond within a reasonable time. If you're in the subject of the data, there's a special provision that requires the government entity to respond immediately or at least within 10 days, again, as long as you're the data subject. A couple other specific issues related to requests for data and fees in Minnesota. Government entities are allowed to charge additional reasonable fees for data if it has a commercial value, and the person requesting that data can ask that the agency justify the additional commercial value fee and prove that with sufficient documentation, again, to justify that fee. And also, government entities can limit a person's access to private data on them. So if an individual is asking for private data on themselves, to only once in a six-month period. So that avoids repeated requests from the same individual for the same piece of data. There are a couple of state agency structures for oversight of the Data Practices Act in Minnesota. First is through the Commissioner of Administration. The Commissioner is authorized to issue advisory opinions related to the Data Practices Act. The Commissioner has issued 965 of those since 1993. In 2001, the Commissioner hit a high mark of 96 opinions in that year. More recently, the advisory opinions have hovered somewhere in the 15 to 20 range over the past few years. The Commissioner of Administration is also authorized to issue temporary classifications of data. So this is where a government entity has a new piece of data and they don't feel that there's time for the legislature to come and classify it. They can request that the data be temporarily classified until there is an opportunity for legislative action. Since 1977, when this authorization was first put in the statute, the Commissioner has approved 182 temporary classifications, although the number of classifications that have been enacted that way has dropped off fairly significantly in the past couple of decades, and the Commissioner has only approved 30 of those classifications since 1991. Currently, there is one temporary classification that's in effect. That's for automated license plate readers, which will expire on August 1st, 2015. And just this past weekend, last Friday, there was a new request for a temporary classification for body camera data, and that request was denied by the Commissioner of Administration. Much of the Commissioner's work is funneled through the Information Policy Analysis Division. I know you're all very familiar with the staff at that office. IPAD is the agency that really works with the public, conducts education, and facilitates some of the data practices work through the Commissioner's office. In addition to oversight by the Commissioner of Administration and the Department of Administration, there are also a couple of procedures available for remedies and enforcement of the Act. One is through the Office of Administrative Hearings. OAH is authorized to hear complaints and issues orders for compliance. This is a relatively new procedure that's enacted, that was enacted in 2010. Since enactment, the OAH has heard and resolved 17 cases. They do issue an annual report once every year to the legislature on their issues related to the data practices hearings, and one of the things that they have noted repeatedly in each of their annual reports is that they're concerned about some of the fee issues. So if you're interested in exploring that further, there's a lot of information on the OAH website and in the reports about those issues. In addition to enforcement through the Office of Administrative Hearings, there are other procedures in Chapter 13 for enforcing the law, including an allowance for a person to file it for a civil action for damages. The Act allows exemplary damages if they prove that a government entity has willfully violated the Act. Exemplary damages can range from $1,000 to $15,000 per violation. An individual is also entitled to be awarded attorney's fees if it shows that the government entity fails to follow an advisory opinion that, on the issue that has been issued by the Commissioner of Administration. There are also criminal penalties in the Act. It's a misdemeanor to willfully violate the Act. And public employees who willfully violate the Act are also subject to suspension without pay or dismissal if they willfully violate the Act. A couple other relevant Minnesota laws that relate to data practices outside of the scope of Chapter 13 are the Official Records Act. This is in Section 15.17. This is the section of statute that governs the types of records that must be kept by agencies. In Chapter 138 is the Records Retention Statute. This is the State Archives chapter, and there are procedures in there for government entities to establish a process and a schedule for when data can be destroyed. There are administrative rules for data practices laws in Chapter 1205. So these are sort of implementation rules that are adopted by the Commissioner of Administration to further the intent of Chapter 13. Then there are also various sort of topic-specific laws governing data outside of the scope of Chapter 13 and sometimes outside the scope of government data. This includes the Health Records Act in Chapter 141 and Business Screening Services in Chapter 332. So that's the basic overview of how Chapter 13 works. And again, I know you all kind of know that, but I put this material in the presentation just so you can refer back to it as I move through and talk about some of the procedures in federal law and in other states. But at this point, if you have questions, I'm happy to take questions on Chapter 13.
Well, and you might be able to use this again in a couple of weeks in the civil law committee too.
That was the intent, Madam Chair. So a different structure is in federal law than what we have in Chapter 13, and you're all familiar with FOIA, which is the Freedom of Information Act. The Freedom of Information Act at the federal level was enacted by Congress in 1966. It's been subject to significant amendments since then, including a number of amendments in 2007. There's also some directives from the Department of Justice that relate to implementation of FOIA, and there's also a new piece of legislation that's moving right now. I think it passed the Senate on December 8th to adopt some additional amendments to FOIA. I don't know if that bill in particular has been heard in the House, but there is legislation moving to further codify some of the directives that the Department of Justice and the President's Office have issued related to implementation of the Act. The basic concept in the Freedom of Information Act is to ensure an informed citizenry and prevent secret law. That's sort of the intent of the law. And the presumption in the Freedom of Information Act is that records are disclosable unless they're either exempt or they're excluded. So I'll start with what excluded means first. This is a relatively new concept, and excluded is a piece of law that applies particularly to law enforcement records. And the best way to illustrate this is the concept that allows a government entity to either to neither confirm nor deny the existence of a record. So if a piece of federal data is excluded under the law, that means that the entity is allowed to not disclose it. The entity is allowed to respond to requests as if the data doesn't exist. The second type of provision that would prevent disclosure of a piece of data under the federal act is for data that's exempt. And this is the list of categories that are exempt under FOIA. Unlike in Chapter 13, where each specific piece of data has to be classified in statute, the federal law has general categories of data, and it's up to the agency to decide whether a piece of data fits under one of the categories. So for example, some pieces of data that are held by a federal agency may be classified material. They may be personnel rules. They may be disclosure may be prohibited by other statutes. They may be confidential commercial or financial information. They may relate to personal privacy. They may be related to law enforcement or related to supervision of financial institutions, or maybe GIS or other location data. All these general categories of data are allowed to be exempt under FOIA. So if a person makes a request for these data, then the agency can determine that the data fits one of these categories and therefore is not subject to disclosure. A quick Q&A on how FOIA requests work. Any person allowed to make a request for information under the Freedom of Information Act, except for fugitives. Fugitives are prohibited from requesting data that relate to their fugitive status from an entity. And foreign governments are prohibited from making requests for intelligence data using the Freedom of Information Act. Proper requests under FOIA, requests must be made in writing. They must reasonably describe the records requested and comply with agency regulations. An individual is not required to state a specific reason for requesting data under FOIA, although when I get to the fee provision later, sometimes reason is required. Agencies are required to acknowledge a request within 20 days of receipt, and they're required to provide a tracking number and allow the person to go on to the agency's website and actually track the status of a records request. There are provisions in FOIA for expedited processing if there's a compelling need to do so. Typically, compelling needs include things that pieces of data that would be important to disclose to the general public. So news media uses the expedited processing procedure fairly regularly. If an expedited process request is granted, the agency is required to respond within 10 days. Each individual agency in the federal government is allowed to establish its own fee structure for requesting data, and there are procedures for granting waivers for fees. If the request for the waiver relates to data that would make a contribution significantly to public understanding and is for non-commercial use. There are also procedures for appealing denials of requests for data under FOIA. This is the fees table that the federal law uses to determine whether a person can be charged for access to data. In all cases, for both search, individual review, and duplication costs, if the person is requesting data for commercial use, they can be charged fees for those uses. If a person is requesting data for the purpose of education or for scientific research, they cannot be charged any fees for searching for or review of the data, but can be charged duplication costs for duplication above 100 pages. News media has the same standards, so they can have free access to data and have the agency search for and review the data, again, for no fee. But if they request duplication of the data for up more than 100 pages, so they can be charged a fee for that. All others, which would be sort of general members of the public, can be charged a fee for searching for and retrieving data if the request requires more than 2 hours of search time. They cannot be charged a fee for individual review, so this is having a government employee go through the data and see what's available to the public and what isn't available. That needs to be free if a member of the public requests it. And they can be charged a fee for more than 100 pages of data. So that's the quick and dirty overview of FOIA. As you might expect, there's lots of case law and lots of regulations, all sorts of things that relate to FOIA that I haven't included in the presentation here. So if you have specific questions that you want follow up afterwards, I'm happy to go through it in more detail. But that's just kind of the, like I said, sort of the quick and dirty FOIA request. There are lots of resources online that go through in fairly plain English how to go about making requests, what the obligations of agencies are, and all sorts of other things related to actual implementation of the Act.
Thank you.
So the next section of the presentation is related to state open records laws, and this one is a bit more extensive. What I'm going to walk through are procedure or structures in state laws that establish data commissions or public records commissions or offices within states, states that have specific open records ombudsmans, the role of the Attorney General in enforcing public records and data laws, fees and fee waivers in state laws, timeliness, so how often or how quickly a government entity is required to respond to data requests. Then I'm going to quickly walk through a couple of other issues that I know are of interest here in Minnesota and how they're addressed in other states. So there are at least 13 states that have commissions or specific statewide offices that are designed to manage and adjudicate public records issues. I'll walk through some of some examples in just a minute. All of them have kind of fun logos like you have on the slide there. All commissions and offices do have powers to issue advisory opinions, and then some additionally have the power to order an agency to release records, to set fines, report non-compliant agencies to either a law enforcement agency or the Attorney General. Some of them also have the power to actually conduct binding mediation on disputes related to data access. There are two states that require filing a complaint first with a data commission or the data office before a person can file a suit in court. And there are seven states that allow simultaneous actions with a data commission and in court at the same time. So one of the biggest and most developed states or commissions in other states is in the state of Connecticut. The state of Connecticut has the Freedom of Information Commission. This is organized under the Connecticut Office of Governmental Accountability. This commission is a 9-member commission. Five of the members of the commission are appointed by the governor and require legislative consent, and four of the commissioners are appointed directly by legislative leaders in the state. The Connecticut Commission is allowed to hear complaints from persons who have been denied access to records, and they also enforce and interpret provisions related to their state's open meeting law. The Commission does have the authority to order disclosure of public records. They can void a decision of a local government if it was reached in the course of a meeting that was not compliant with public open meetings law, and they can also order other appropriate relief as they see fit. In the state of Hawaii, they have the Hawaii Office of Information Practices. This office is a single administrative office that's organized under the Lieutenant Governor, although I would note that in the Hawaii Office of Information Practices annual report, they actually are trying to get out of the Lieutenant Governor's office and are seeking to sort of be their own independent agency. It sounds like that's been an issue that's been going on in that state for quite a while. The Hawaii office has jurisdiction to investigate agency action, and they also have what's called an attorney of the day service. So this is an attorney designated to take public comments and questions, and they also provide legal guidance to individual members of the public on implementation of the Data Practices Act and or their Data Practices Act and how to make requests for records. The Hawaii office is also authorized to issue both formal and informal opinions. They facilitate an appeals process, so if a piece of data, if a data request is denied, a person can go to the Office of Information Practices to seek relief there. And then there's also an allowance in their act to seek private remedies through a court process. In the state of Illinois, they don't have a commission, but they have one individual person who's called the Public Access Counselor. This person works within the Office of the Attorney General, and this person's mission is to help individuals basically obtain documents and access public meetings the way you might expect. This Public Access Counselor also mediates disputes and issues both advisory and binding opinions related to records access that agencies in the state of Illinois must comply with. The state of Indiana also has a public access counselor. Unlike Illinois, in Indiana, this person is appointed by the governor and works within the office of the governor. The Indiana Access Counselor educates the public and answers inquiries, like all commissions and offices. They also do advisory opinions and informal opinions in response to complaints. If a person is seeking relief through a court process and wants to be awarded attorney's fees at the end of that process, they are required to consult and get an opinion from the Public Access Counselor first before the attorney's fees would be authorized in law. One of the newest commissions is in the state of Iowa. Iowa adopted what's called the Public Information Board and a fairly significant public access law in 2012. And that has led to the creation of this board that I've got on the slide here. There are 9 members of the Iowa Public Information Board appointed by the governor. They do require Senate approval. Membership on the board requires party balance and also requires membership from the media, from local government agencies, and also citizen representation and some other categories of people. So most of the commissions in other states don't have specific qualifications for membership, but in Iowa they do have specific qualifications. The Iowa Public Information Board conducts trainings, can issue binding and advisory opinions, and they answer questions from both agencies and members of the public about access to public records in the state. And they have jurisdiction over both the state's open meetings law and the public records law. In the state of Massachusetts, they have a supervisor of public records. This is an administrative official within the office of the Secretary of the Commonwealth. The Massachusetts supervisor has discretion to review cases and may review, has an appeals process, but is allowed to refuse to accept appeals under certain circumstances. If the supervisor of public records finds a violation of the state's public records law, they do have discretion to report those things to either the attorney general or the district attorney for prosecution. New Jersey has a government records council. This is a 5-member council. 3 of the members of the council are appointed by the governor, and additionally on the council are the commissioner of education in that state and the commissioner of community affairs. The New Jersey council issues advisory opinions on accessibility of records and also conducts mediations and can assist in resolution of disputes related to records access.
Mr. Gehring, if you know, is this the body that acted on body cameras recently in New Jersey? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I guess I would have to look back at their records. I was just kind of doing the quick scan of their structure. I can take a look and get back to you.
All right, thank you.
In the state of New York, has the Committee on Open Government. This committee acts as an ombudsman and provides opinions, guidelines, and information regarding disclosure of public records laws. They oversee both their Freedom of Information Law, which is their Government Records Act, the Open Meetings Law, and also a Personal Privacy Protection Law, which is more of a protection and rights for private individuals. The state of New York in their annual report provides extensive recommendations. It's actually a fairly interesting read if you want to read it, on issues related to personal privacy and public records issues in the state. So their annual most of these commissions, I would say, do sort of extensive annual reporting to the legislature. But in the case of New York, they have a fairly extensive sort of narrative reporting of issues that they're seeing and recommendations for amendments and issues for the legislature to consider. The state of Pennsylvania has the biggest open records law office of the states that we surveyed for this presentation. Connecticut is the second largest. They have, as I said, the fairly large commission and a staff of 15. In the state of Pennsylvania, the Office of Open Records has a staff of 12 and a $2 million budget per year. They were established in 2009. In addition to conducting appeals processes for requests for public records that are denied and issuing final determinations, they also have a more direct role in the actual implementation of the act among agencies. So, for example, they actually develop forms that people can use to make records requests. Usually the process is that a person can make a request just by sending a letter or making a phone call or whatever. In the state of Pennsylvania, they can do that, or they can also go through this process that the Office of Open Records has established, where you fill out a form and you actually have a set kind of uniform procedure that any person can use for any agency or government entity within that state. In the state of Tennessee, they have an Office of Open Records Council. This is an administrative office established within the Office of the Comptroller of the Treasury. The Tennessee Office of Open Records assists with obtaining public records from local government. So my understanding from their website is they actually can get access to data from a local government and provide it to a person if they make a request. They can also guide citizens to correct offices and officials and also assist in resolving disputes between government entities and individuals who are seeking access to records. In addition to the Open Records Council, Tennessee also has an advisory committee on open government that advises the legislature on proposed legislation. So I think their structure with this advisory committee on open government is similar to what you all are doing with this commission. It serves in sort of an advisory role, but I believe it does have a little bit more direct correlation or direct relationship with the Office of Open Records Council than you have established in law here. And finally, the state of Utah has a state records committee. This is a 7-member committee. Like Iowa, the committee in Utah represents various interests, including media, members of the public, and government entities. The state of Utah also has an open records ombudsman, which is appointed by the state archivist. The state records committee conducts hearings, reviews records, and does have the authority to order disclosure of records if they've been denied by a local unit of government. The committee also can assess fines to individuals to government entities for not complying with the law. And if they find noncompliance, they forward a report of noncompliance to the governor, to what's called the Legislative Management Committee in that state, and also a judicial council in the state. There is an authorization also in the state of Utah. So if a person has been denied access to records and has been denied access by the state records committee, for that person to file an action in district court to seek judicial relief. So that's a quick run-through of some of the states that have particular things that I thought were of interest and a little bit different than the way Minnesota conducts data practices business here. This table is designed to kind of give you a summary of the types of offices and commissions that exist in other states. I also have budget numbers there and staff numbers and sort of organization. So a lot of what you see on the table here I've already talked about. But I thought some of the budget numbers and staff complements would be interesting. I did include Minnesota on this table, so the staffing numbers and the budget numbers for the state of Minnesota are for iPad, so I got that data directly from iPad themselves. They have a $463,000 annual budget and a staff of 4.5 FTEs currently. This next table is just a quick summary of appointed commissions. So there are 6 states that have appointed public records commissions, this table shows the number of members in each state on their commission, who they're appointed by, and some of the qualifications for serving, also the term length and whether they have particular responsibilities. Most of them just hear disputes and can actually resolve disputes if they're requested to do so. In the state of Tennessee, it's just an advisory committee, the same as you have here. And I realize that the print on these tables is fairly small for a PowerPoint slide, so I do have full-size copies if you want to actually be able to read what I have on the table. The next topic that I'm just going to quickly run through are state ombudsmans. There are 4 states that have a general state ombudsman available to hear complaints about access to public records. You've already heard about a couple of them in Utah and Iowa. In addition, Alaska has a procedure and a state ombudsman for individuals. An individual can seek the assistance of the state ombudsman if they're denied access to certain records, but generally in the state of Alaska, my understanding is that people kind of rely on their own resources and don't use this ombudsman all that often. There's a Office of an Ombudsman Citizens Aid in the state of Arizona, which has investigative powers and the ability to make recommendations to agencies, but my understanding is it's not a binding authority. In the state of Arizona, this ombudsman is not a specific public records ombudsman, but sort of a ombudsman for government access. So this person hears complaints and issues related to all sorts of types of government services, including their open meetings law and Public Records Act. The Office of the Ombudsman in Iowa does have statutory authority to investigate complaints about government and the open records law, like Arizona. And finally, I've already talked about the ombudsman in Utah, who is available to respond to assist a person responding to records requests and can intervene and help mediate disputes between individual requesters and government entities when issues arise. As far as Attorney General involvement in public records laws, in the state of Minnesota, there is no direct statutory authorization or power for the Attorney General to be involved, although our state Attorney General does have sort of general authority to issue advisory opinions, and that does sometimes happen in data practices issues, although not too frequently because of the IPAT process. In 12 states, there is direct Attorney General power to bring suit or on behalf of citizens to enforce their open records law or their open meetings law. And seven states have agencies which have procedures for appealing decisions of agencies directly to the state's attorney general if a person feels that they've had an unfair result. Once an appeal is made to the attorney general, then the attorney general can manage the appeals process, and in some states, but not all, can have some final binding authority over decisions made by local entities related to public access. And again, this is just a table kind of summarizing the powers of attorney generals in states. The one thing that was fairly unique is in the state of Texas, their attorney general actually has the power to determine the amount of fees that an agency can charge for access to records. That was the only state that we found that had that particular authority. And a couple slides related to fees and fee waivers. 12 states have provisions in their statute mandating that fees be waived if a person has made a request and the request is determined to be in the public interest. I've listed the states there that have that provision in law. Usually the public interest determination is at the agency's discretion, so the individual making the request has to sort of prove that they're making requests in the public interest, and it's kind of up to the agency to decide whether they're going to grant the fee waiver or not. In the state of Oregon, there is an appeals process, so if a fee waiver is denied, a person can appeal through the state of Oregon's process. The state of Louisiana also has a fee waiver process for indigent persons. I won't read through these next couple of slides in great detail, but I included them just so you can see the actual language. This is the language from the state of Oklahoma with their public interest fee waiver provision. The state of Texas also has a fee waiver provision for public interest requests, and Oregon does as well. And then finally, this is the language from the state of Louisiana related to fee waivers for individuals who are indigent or who have a public purpose. One of the issues that comes up on a fairly regular basis here in Minnesota are issues related to timeliness of responses by government entities. As you know, in Minnesota law, there is no specific timeline for when an agency needs to respond. They're required to respond within a reasonable period. And as I said earlier, if you're the subject of the data, then they're supposed to respond within 10 days. This chart shows the states that do have an actual timeline in statute for when an agency needs to respond. In most cases, these timelines just mean that the agency is required to give a response to the person within the set amount of time. It doesn't necessarily require that the data actually be produced within this amount of time. So basically, what's happening here is that an agency, for example, if you're in the state of Michigan, the agency needs to respond to a person within 5 days to let them know that the request is in process, and then provide additional information about when the data is expected to be produced. The one little caveat here is the state of Mississippi, which has a one-day response time. This, I think, is actually not in practice the way that it actually works in Mississippi. So the law in Mississippi is that unless the government entity provides for a different procedure in law, then they are required to respond within one day. And I think this has meant that the sort of the hook to get government entities to actually pay attention to the law and actually adopt some procedures. So the real procedure or the real deadline in Mississippi is probably 7 days. That's the maximum they can be. That's the maximum time in law for a response. But if there's some entity in Mississippi that hasn't adopted that 7-day standard, then the statute does require them to respond within one day. A couple of other issues that are common public records issues that I know have been discussed here in Minnesota include excessive requests for data. So these are requests where a person has is seeking data repeatedly or is requesting data for sort of frivolous purposes or really is making burdensome requests of government entity. There are 9 states that have procedures in law for how to handle these types of requests. Some of them allow the government entity to limit the amount of data they provide. Some of them provide additional fee structures for individuals who are making excessive requests for data. And there's some other procedures as well. So if you'd like additional information on that, I do have that in my book here, and I'm happy to take questions. There's also a number of states that have provisions in statute, including here in Minnesota, for conducting IT security audits. There are 13 states that have that. The procedures for security audits do vary somewhat by state, but in general, they require review of state agency computer systems and software to ensure that they're secure and, to the extent possible, safe from hackers and other sorts of improper access. And finally, there are 47 states that have laws related to security breaches. Some of these laws do apply to government entities, and some of these laws are just more general security breach laws that a government entity may or may not need to comply with. And 31 states, not including Minnesota, do require particular destruction of personal identifying information if the data is particularly at risk, and this can apply both to private sector data and public sector data in certain circumstances. And finally, as I said at the beginning, I know there's a lot of content in this presentation, so I did include some websites for additional information if you want to read about a particular topic or have more questions. Really good resources include NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures. Of course, IPAD provides a lot of information and is always willing to help legislators when they have questions. A couple of other guides that may be of interest include a guide that's created by what's called the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. They have extensive guides on every state's laws that you can print out, including a guide in the state of Minnesota. That's very helpful. If you're interested in more information about the Federal Freedom of Information Act, the U.S. Department of Justice has what's called the Guide to the Freedom of Information Act, and it's a very, very extensive, well-cited, and very lengthy publication, but it is useful if you're interested in learning more about how that process works. And finally, the National Association of Counties has a report called Open Records Laws, a state-by-state report that I did use a fair amount in putting this presentation together.
Well, Mr. Gehring, thank you very much. I think in all my years here, I don't know, I've seen so much information put all together in one presentation, and I hope it's helpful to those members of the commission that will be working next year. I think there's lots of good ideas. And Mr. Gehring?
I just want to make one other comment, which is that we do have a law clerk in our office, Soren Lagarde, who was very helpful in kind of putting these slides together, so I want to make sure he gets some credit for putting some work into this presentation as well. He wasn't able to be here today, but he was hoping to be here. So.
I think it's a really good compilation of a lot of information, and I know that as we've had these series of meetings over the last couple months, at times I have felt really overwhelmed with all of the outstanding issues and the fact that we, on many levels, at least in my opinion, we're way behind the curve and having this information about what some other states are doing to try and get a handle. It's not unique to Minnesota that issues are coming at us, very complex issues, very rapidly with competing interests. Hopefully commission members will find this helpful, and members of the audience as well, as you're moving forward on legislation. We were planning on hearing Senator Peterson's bill next, but given that he's not in the room, I think what I'd first like to do is have Representative Scott move the minutes from December 17th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved from the December 17th meeting. So I think we'll go to agenda item number 5. And we got a number of issues we're going to try and wrap up or get a little bit of direction or resolution. Some of them have kind of resolved themselves. And if Ms. Christensen would like to come to the table, we heard a lot of information on body cameras. And I've City of Duluth did file for a temporary application last week. I've printed copies of their cover letter and application. If you want to take one and pass it down, given we're short on staff today. But she's here to report us to with the Department of Administration's action on the application that they received last week from the City of Duluth. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commission members. My name is Stacey Christensen with the Information Policy Analysis Division in the Department of Administration. And as Representative Holberg mentioned, the City of Duluth filed an application for temporary classification related to the body cam data last Wednesday on December 17th, and the Commissioner of Administration exercised his authority in Minnesota Statute Section 13.06 to immediately reject the application based primarily on the fact that the data are already classified in law and that a temporary classification process cannot reclassify data. The data they requested to be classified were inactive investigative data, which are specifically classified as public in statute.
All right. Any questions for Ms. Christensen on that issue? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say active or inactive?
Inactive.
Ms. Christensen. All right. Any additional questions? So I think, members, that probably means that you're going to have lots of work to do on this issue in the upcoming months as well. So thank you very much for that update. It's one of the items we can cross off of our agenda item number 5. And then also, I think we have an update on this bulk sale of driver's license and vehicle records. Deputy Commissioner Dinansky, who is for now the deputy commissioner, but I understand will always be a colonel. So welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and provide an update to the committee on the bulk record sale at the Department of Public Safety. Welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. The last time that I was before you, there were some questions regarding the sale of bulk data under the new Department of Public Safety subscription service. At that time, there was a lot of conversation between formats. The format that was talked about was comma delimited, if we can use that terminology. And there was some confusion about whether we were giving that out or why we'd give it out and that we would charge $5 for that. In going back and doing research on that, I found that the department clarified that the Department of Public Safety has never used comma delimited that format in using or in the bulk data process or in the sale of bulk data. And so there was a little bit of confusion between us and some of the vendors as far as what the format was going to be. Since that time, we have had conversations with one of the vendors regarding that confusion and the fact that the format that we're using, the fixed length file format, I believe is what it's referred to, is we're going to continue to use that format, but it is slightly modified. And so we are having conversations with the vendors that are interested in getting the data so we can work through that process to get the data in the format that they need it to be in.
Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Dinansky? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Deputy Commissioner Dinansky and his team, as well as the stakeholders, for some pretty careful discussion and trying to sort out some misunderstandings here. As is often the case in this particular issue, you get into some technical, what does one mean when one says the file has not, the format has not changed? And so it's a lot of effort has gone in, but I think everybody has been operating in good faith. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble. Deputy Commissioner Dinansky, so at this point, using the $5 per record will only be used for, say, individual buyers that are, you know, buying a handful of records, but that what your bulk use customers, if you will, that have historically accessed this information for their lawful purposes would then fall under the constraints of the legislation that was passed in May with a limit on, I think it was a penny or two per record after paying a subscription fee. Is that how you're moving forward then?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right. Any additional questions? Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak to the issue of bulk record sales at this time? Okay, thank you. We appreciate the update on that one. Now, is anybody in the audience from Senator Peterson's office that could inform the commission whether he's intending to come today or not? All right. The next issue that we need to discuss is the license plate reader policy. We have been struggling with this issue for a couple of years now. I've had various bills presented, and it is the right of this commission to make recommendations to the legislature, and I believe Representative Lesch has been working on something on this issue.
Madam Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the commission, the proposal you see before you is a proposal that reflects a three-year-old issue of trying to address this ever since the 2012 situation in Minneapolis, which was the reason for the temporary designation, which will expire on August 1st. And there have been attempts over the course of the 2013 session as well as the 2014 session to address this to no avail. But many legislators felt that, it wasn't immediate because the designation doesn't expire until August 1st of 2015, and we got a lot of other things to worry about, so let's put this on the back burner. There also has been a reluctance to arrive at a good position. Therefore, I have put this forth in order to make a recommendation to both bodies that we resolve the issue and enshrine it in law under the recommendations of this proposal. And what this does, members, is that the primary thing that this does is state that there will be, if you have not hit data, that means if an automatic license plate reader has images of license plates for which there is no reason to keep it, no reasonable suspicion or probable cause, then that data cannot be retained. And I understand that there has been opposition to this on the part of law enforcement on the speculation that we could come up with something someday that would make that data useful. And while that remains true, there has been no counterproposal to put this before a judge to determine whether or not that can be seen. It just remains under the control of law enforcement. So with that, you have the proposal in front of you. I assume there would probably be some discussion on it. I also would note that the Senate had previously passed a version stating that there would be a 90-day retention period for non-hit data. It is my suspicion and expectation that we may not ultimately arrive at the zero-day designation for non-hit data. I firmly believe that if you're innocent, there is no reason for law enforcement or government of this country to be keeping information on you, the basis for which they can later prosecute you. I don't think that that is appropriate. That said, the technology is out there. Some people believe that this will be useful, and I expect that any subsequent compromise will be approached in good faith by both sides. But I would note, members, that last commission meeting, despite the fact that law enforcement put forth a 90-day determination in previous sessions, that the letter that came out from the chiefs of police stated now they wanted 180 days. In light of that backpedaling of position, I would ask that we go forward into this session recommending both bodies pass a zero-day designation. And if there is, in fact, a reason to retain data on innocent people, that it go before a judge And that would be a subsequent provision in any amendment or agreement that we come to. So with that, members, I put the proposal forward for the consideration of the commission.
All right. Thank you. Representative Lesh, is there any commission members that have any questions on his recommendation as provided in the document in your packet? All right. I'm assuming that there's probably people from law enforcement that may want to comment on this or not. Anybody in the audience like to testify, whether it be law enforcement or anybody else, on the recommendations in front of the commission at this point? All right. You want to make that in a form of a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move the proposal you have in front of you to be passed by the commission, this commission, as recommended action for the legislature. Is that the appropriate form?
And I think it would be helpful for you to specify who you'd like this provided to. I'm guessing caucus leaders and chairs of the relevant committees would receive
a
copy of these recommendations from the commission.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would ask that the speaker, majority leader of each body, as well as the minority leader, and the chairs of judiciary, public safety, and civil law, as well as the leads on those committees. We provided
right.
copies.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, just a
Senator
question
Lemmer.
For Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh, in the event that we, if this was passed, and a judge would have discretion to, did you say classify this information or allow law enforcement to hold information of non-criminal subjects for whatever reason, would we also be giving them any time limit to how long that information could be held? Or is it strictly allowing a court to use its own discretion?
Madam Chair,
Representative
Senator Lemmer, I think that's a great question. I would think that law enforcement themselves would probably self-regulate in light of the number of records they have to keep and the data storage costs, but I don't know the answer to that. And maybe a subsequent limit would still be appropriate, that, mm-hmm. in fact, in the space of, I don't know, maybe a year, a judge could peer in and say, okay, you can look at it under these parameters. Maybe longer, maybe shorter, but I don't know the answer to that right now. If there is a judge in place, Senator Lemmer, as a gateway to this data, I am far more comfortable with the amount of time that this data is held. I'm still a little bit nervous, but I think I hope that answers your question.
And Madam Chair, I understand that we probably would have a lot more policy discussion in a committee. Some of the questions that I might bring up in a committee would be the cost factor. Would law enforcement be the appropriate entity to self-regulate itself into perpetuity as far as collection of data? How is there a limit even to that practice of having a judge say that they could collect data? Is there any limit to that as far as holding? Right now, if we would have followed the Senate limitation, there would at least be a bright line of departure that they could not hold data any longer than what the Senate had had. In your example, although I'm comforted by a court reviewing it, there doesn't seem to be a time limit on it. And so that could be probably something that we discuss in committee.
Well, and Senator Lemmer, what we have before us is just some standards or principles around.
I understand.
And I think that Chair Lesh's comments about law enforcement coming back and making a case and a high standard for access for any longer storage could be a further discussion. But I think that these principles reflect what I believe to be the majority of commissioners' opinions, that we haven't seen a proposal yet with storage that has high enough standard for access to that stored data to satisfy our concerns about innocent individuals' records being held by law enforcement. And so I think there's more work to do, but as a matter of basic principles, I'm completely comfortable with this as direction to the committees. And, you know, we know that in August, if nothing's done during this legislative session, the temporary classification will expire. The information will become public, and while certain there's a number of risks with that being the case, one of the things that would happen is in August we would find out how they were using it. We would find out where these cameras were and how frequently they were used. There, I mean, some of those kinds of questions that we haven't been able to get answers to, or proposals that have had the accountability factor in the use of them that have been rejected by law enforcement, we would find out a lot of information in August about just how this technology was being used that we're not able as yet to be able to fully understand. So I don't think it should get to the August date, but I think that there is strong motivation on both sides to get some type of workable resolution done in the next legislative session. Okay. All right, any other questions? All right, I'm sorry, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate the issues in the discussion here, but I am concerned that we would be coming out with this recommendation that says no retention at all. You know, as Senator Limmer has described and as Representative Lesch has articulated, you know, we can see a vision with good, solid, tight controls on the use of potential data with a line a little further out than zero that allows that opportunity. I am concerned about saying it just goes away. While I think there's a lot of valuable stuff in here, I am concerned about that being the recommendation that comes from this body, because I think it is going to carry some weight. Mm-hmm. So I just share that.
All right. Any other questions, concerns? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm comfortable with this. I respect other people's perspectives and points of view, absolutely. I think law enforcement has come forward with some great rationale for some retention, but it's balanced against a principle I've articulated many times. What business does law enforcement have to surveil all of us all the time? Whether or not that's retained for a week, 2 weeks, 90 days, 160, whatever. I just think in this country, in our community, law enforcement keeping track of all of our movements and having some ability to retain that because it might be useful to their purposes at some point, it is a real sticking point for me. And I just have to say I am still stuck on the fact this technology was purchased and utilized with no thought about the responsible utilization of that information until we found out in the newspaper everywhere our mayor was going. I don't know what it's going to take to persuade law enforcement to not behave in a manner in which you would expect to find in other places that don't have that kind of accountability to civil authority. We've got to persuade law enforcement to behave much, much more responsibly when they use these very, very powerful information tools.
All right, any other comments? Okay, Chair Lesch, would you like to renew your motion that the commission adopt the principles as outlined in your December 15th letter and provide it to the caucus leaders and chairs and leads of the relevant committees in the House and the Senate?
I would so move, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Your motion's adopted. And just for a matter of process? Is the commission comfortable with a letter with the co-chairs signing, or do you all want to put your actual signature on these letters as upcoming holiday week? And I just want to make sure that we do it right here.
I'm comfortable with the co-chairs signing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now, let's see. Back to no word on Senator Peterson. We also have, I'm wondering, Min Koji, if you would like to present your document. I don't have, it's not in our file, but I know you are working on or have some thoughts about moving forward. Mr. Ayling, if you want to come to the table and present to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I won't belabor this. We've testified on a lot of issues over the course of time here. I'll focus briefly on two things. One is a procedural matter. I think that watching how this commission has operated over the last few months really has provided a much better process than what we had in place, and I would really thank all of you for giving these matters such deep attention. And I think that the as you talk to your colleagues, we would really like to ask that this commission be extended additional resources and continued, because we think this is a much better way to deal with these kinds of matters. And I'm happy to take questions about any of the individual issues that we brought forward. The one thing that I did want to call out, because we talked about this a bit in civil law, is in regard to HMO data. And I think those folks who are curious to watch this debate go forward, we think it's unlikely that the plans are going to bring forward a proposal to extend a blanket classification this session. They are going to ask for specific pieces of data to be classified as not public. And I think that's really where you need to watch. If they're going to be asking for things like administrative expenses, that to be kept not public, provider payment rates, these are the key pieces of information that will give you an understanding of what the plans are doing with public money. And so I would just be very, very careful as you watch and scrutinize the proposals that are brought forward. And I'd be happy to take any additional questions.
Any questions? I do have one. It was my understanding that your organization was working on some principles around surveillance technologies, and maybe they aren't ready for prime time at this, but could you just give an update to the commission on that issue and your rationale to the degree that you're able to at this point, kind of as a fair warning, or where you're moving in that arena as well?
Sure, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to cede my time to Mr. Gemberling, who's been working on this matter.
Madam Chair, Don Gemberling from Min Koji, and from 45 years of studying this stuff. This is one of those government publications that in many places gathers dust. It's called Records, Computers, and the Rights of Citizens. It was published in 1974, and it was the product of a group of citizens and bureaucrats and lawyers and academics. And strangely enough, the recommendations in this book became the basis for essentially all legislation about, most legislation about data practices, data privacy in this country. When the chair and I don't sign the notice of practices at our health clinics, the reason they use the word privacy practices is because of this book. Okay? The reason you have a Data Practices Act in this state is because of this book. Okay? Now, this group proposed at the time, and their focus was on the emergence of what they called data banks. What they proposed was, because of the change in our society with the emergence of large-scale data processing capabilities, that we establish certain information fair information practice principles, and that's what became the basis of legislation. So in listening to your discussions about being able to have some principles on which to go forward, what I finally thought about was, why don't we take these principles, which are kind of out of date because of their focus, but have some sense to them of the things that we ought to be concerned about, and inject into that the idea of what should we address about surveillance. Okay? And so what I did is I essentially updated the principles. And I don't know if you have copies. Or you want me to just quick go through them?
I do not have copies printed. I wasn't sure whether that was the intent for today or not. And maybe they got forwarded to Ms. Olson, and given her family situation, that may have caused us. If you have two copies, maybe we can get a staff member to make copies for the committee. Thank you very much.
I want to emphasize, with except for the kind of differences in technology, these really are based on what was in here. Okay? Principle number one, there should be no use of surveillance technology whose very existence, use, and operation is secret. Okay? That goes, I think, to Senator Dibble's point for policymakers, which is you should find out about license plate readers by reading the Minneapolis Tribune. So, now, how is that principle currently implemented? A couple of ways. The Federal Privacy Act requires that the federal government give public notice of all systems of data they maintain on individuals. Now, obviously, since 911, that has been modified, so there are some systems of data they maintain on individuals that they don't have to report on, but that was the way the feds did it. In Minnesota, you advance that principle by requiring government agencies to do a report back in the 70s on what kind of data they maintain on people and to update that report annually. I got to tell you, it probably doesn't get updated much, but that's the way you implemented the principle. Individuals who are the subject of surveillance technology should, except in limited instances, be able to find out that they are or have been the subject of surveillance and how the data and images about them are or have been used. Just like the data principle in here, except talking about surveillance. Individuals who are or have been the subject of surveillance technology should have access to any data, records, or media that records the surveillance of them. Now, you can make an argument under the current Data Practices Act that, to some extent, they already have that right, okay? But that would put a more of a focus on surveillance. Principle number four, images, recordings, and any other type of data that results from the use of surveillance technology should only be used for the purposes for which the technology was first intended to be utilized and shall not be used for any other purposes except for purposes authorized by the individual surveillance subject. That's what, in this history, is referred to as the secondary use principle. And it's the idea that when you give data to an organization for one purpose, they shouldn't be able to use it for other purposes without your consent. How you implemented the data principle in Minnesota is a combination of the Tennyson warning, the notice to individuals, and that's coupled with some limitations by the legislature on use and collection and dissemination of data on individuals.
And I think we heard testimony last week how the education data that was collected under one pretext in the 90s, going back as far as I think she said 98 or 99, is now being used for longitudinal studies being collated with work wage data, and so I think we have some good examples where we're even in the written form we're falling away from that principle and our current standards.
Mm-hmm. Number five, organizations and individuals utilizing surveillance technology must be held to the highest standard of accountability, including strict adherence to the U.S. Fourth Amendment and other Bill of Rights protections, and any applicable state constitutional provisions that protect individual privacy, free speech, and free association rights. Okay. Somewhere in the background of all of this are lots of discussions about the government intruding into our First Amendment rights. Okay. California, which was, I think, the first state to pass a constitutional privacy protection explicitly in their state constitution. They did that using the sometimes famous, sometimes infamous California referendum methodology. The very first case they had under their state constitutional provision was the law enforcement attending meetings of environmental groups on the thought that those environmental groups might in the future turn violent. Okay, and the California Supreme Court said that was a violation of the California constitutional provision. Number six, the decision and actions of eight organizations using surveillance technology should be subject to review by an independent court or other body. An organization should be accountable with a full range of sanctions and penalties for any violations of these principles. Those of you who have known me for a long time know that the one thing I've learned about these kinds of laws is unless you have effective ways of enforcing them, they don't work the way you really want them to work. And the Tennyson warning is a good example of that problem. Okay, you know, if in a given situation a government agency chooses, even though they're required to do so, not to give me a Tennyson warning, I got to sue them. And in the usual common way that jurisprudence works in this country, how am I going to get any damages because I didn't get a Tennyson warning? Okay, and the answer is almost impossible to prove. Okay, on the freedom of information side, we're now seeing all kinds of interesting arguments being made by organizations about why they can't release data that's been public by statute for years. And if you don't like that, yeah, I got to sue them. Okay? And as always, it's this kind of relationship. The government has free lawyers. We have to hire lawyers to enforce the law. By free, I mean, actually, we're paying for those lawyers now that I think about it. So I think part of the ongoing discussion, and you've seen that in some of this nice work that Mr. Gehring did, there are all kinds of ways to approach this, but just letting it go to court, frankly, I don't think works. The principle number seven, there must be a way for an individual who is or has been the subject of surveillance to correct or amend the surveillance images or data, including a right to correct or supplement images or data that place the individual in a false light. False light terminology is old privacy law, okay? And again, that's based on one of the principles in here, the correction principles. And with data, you implement that in Minnesota by allowing people to challenge the accuracy and completeness of data about themselves when it's maintained by a government agency in this state. So now, is this a perfect piece of work? No. But in thinking about giving you some kind of principles, This is where I went. I think everybody is aware of the old fair information practice principles. You know, we're now saying, how old are they? 40 years? Team Miriam is always correcting my arithmetic. And to some extent, they reflect that. But thinking about updating along those lines, I think, is worthy of your consideration. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Gimberling? Thank you. I know that in my years of work in this area, sticking to those principles made a lot of decisions pretty easy because they made sense. And if you tried to develop policies that adhered to those principles, it answered a lot of questions or maybe in turn helped you ask the right questions in developing the principles. This whole new issue of surveillance data, I think, is going to be very difficult. I appreciate this information. I would urge the commission to maybe adopt some principles. We can spend our whole time chasing the next technology, whether it be LPR, body cameras, facial recognition. Who knows what's next? If the legislature chooses to enact a law or policy around surveillance data collection in general, whether it's Stingray, body cameras, or who knows what's going to be coming down the line 5-10 years from now, we will have hopefully avoid some of these problems of temporary classifications, and that if we set forth principles that apply to all net new technologies that collect this type of data, then it will provide the much-needed direction to law enforcement. I mean, I am as frustrated as the next, but I don't negate good share of the frustration comes from the legislature's inability or unwillingness to act, not the actions of law enforcement. Law enforcement is just trying to keep the public safe. They come at it from one angle. I don't believe that they should be faulted for that. But we as legislators haven't been very good at responding in a timeline that meets their needs as well. So, I mean, it's kind of a balancing act. So hopefully this commission will be able to move a little more quickly. Hopefully law enforcement will be a little more collaborative and forthright in their approach with the legislature. But I would urge that any law that's passed not be technology specific, but rather adhere to some principles and set up a framework so that maybe you'll have time to work on education data and health data and some of the other things that need attention as well. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I know I think that Senator Peterson, Senate File 2789, kind of went in that direction a little bit. So I'd love to have that conversation at another point. And maybe we could put it back on the agenda for a subsequent commission meeting would be great.
Right. And to that point, if we'll see if there's any questions for the gentleman at the table or anybody in the audience that would like to comment. And then Mr. Gearing will briefly give us an overview. He's been scribbling here along the margins, so he's going to provide us a brief overview. But I expect that Senator Peterson will be reintroducing this legislation next year and that there'll be plenty of opportunity to look at it then as well. Okay? Anybody, any additional comments from the gentleman at the table?
No.
Again, thank you for your information. Senator Dibble.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just basically wanted to say what you said. it was a good summation. I completely agree.
Isn't it amazing?
Getting some of these principles, yeah, we're left and right, it's a beautiful thing. Getting some of these principles embedded into statutory policy, I think we've taken a run at that. We have Chapter 13, and we can strengthen some of those requirements upon any agency, whether it's a public safety agency or anyone who's looking at collecting, surveilling, et cetera. But some of it does absolutely come down to culture, leadership, a willingness. I say some strong things about law enforcement, and I agree completely that their focus is keeping the public safe. But to that end, sometimes I feel like they view some of these principles as getting in their way, and I think that perspective on these basic principles is a flawed perspective. So we need to engage in a much more robust dialogue and conversation. What is the purpose of keeping us safe? It's so that we can continue to enjoy our freedoms. If we don't do that, then we're kind of defeating the whole purpose of civil law and order. So a sense that we need a cultural shift. It probably won't come about until we get some good, strong policies in place and then some good leadership to make sure that those policies are followed.
All right. Thank you. And
thank you,
gentlemen. There's a copy. We were provided a handful of copies of the body camera. It's a study of police body cameras approved by New Jersey lawmakers. There's, I think, four copies. Somebody's going to have to share, but definitely amplifies that we're not the only ones struggling with some of these issues. Anybody in the audience like to comment on the surveillance information, the fair information practice principles that were updated by Mr. Gemberling? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, I just want to make a general comment. This will be
certainly
the only time for today. I'd like to say thank you very much to the commission members and both co-chairs for getting this going along. I think it's going to be, I'm looking forward to it. I very much encourage the other aspect, looking at resources, because there's a lot of stuff out there. A lot of people are willing to help, but you also need a staff to help with that. The third point, I won't belabor because you'll get into it a little bit maybe at another meeting, but the bill that Madam Chair, that Senator Peterson did and Representative Lesch did, Chair Lesch, they're both chief authors of the bill, was an attempt that came out of last year, as you know, last year.
And Mr. Neumeister, Mr. Gehring's going to present
right.
that bill here in a second.
I just
so,
wanted
okay.
to give a background
okay.
to why where it came about was that, as you know, the Stingray came out and the issue about all that. And then for me, I've over the years been trying to say we need to update our laws, communication laws. So for a couple of years, I did a lot of it, finding out how administrative subpoenas are being used to get information in the cloud, our third-party documents, which is less than relevant, which is a very low standard. So I approached Representative Atkins and Chair Dibble and Chair Peterson and Senator Peterson on this bill, to an idea to expand it more broadly. But because of the shortage of the legislative session, Representative Atkins said, let's only deal with location data. And then what you did, you all passed the location data bill. So Senator Peterson and Chair Lesch and some other people who are still interested, let's take a look at more of the expanding kind of thing where all these third parties, where we got all our personal private data. So that was some of the premise of the bill, and I just wanted to give you at least some, if you're going to talk about it, I just at least wanted to give you a little bit. And the Senate Council and House Council work a lot on what you have currently now. Once again, thank you very much. Thank you also for allowing the public to engage on this stuff. It's very important, and there are a lot of new faces other than Rich Neumeister, Don Gemberling, and a couple other people who are becoming more and more interested in that and have testified. And that's the purpose, to get more of the public involved and engaged in helping you make public policy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Neumeister. I can't wouldn't even begin to imagine how many notes and pieces of information you've provided to me over the last 16 years and members that have been working on this issue. So if most people would have given up a long time ago, especially given that you're doing it on your free time for quote-unquote fun. So thank you. Mr. Gehring.
So, Madam Chair, you asked me just to do a sort of technical walkthrough of Senator Peterson's bill. So this is Senate File 2789.
And I'm sorry, if I might, I have been informed that he is ill today, so...
Oh. So this is Senate File 2789, introduced in the Senate last March. What I'm going to do is just sort of a technical walkthrough of the language in the bill so you can find the big pieces, but I'm not presenting on behalf of any proponents or opponents of the bill.
Thank you.
So the real substance of this bill is in Section 3, so it starts on page 2. And the basic policy of the bill that it's proposing is actually on page 3 in Subdivision 2, so lines 3.4 to 3.10. This is language that requires government entities to obtain a search warrant before they obtain personal identifying information about an individual. They're required in order to get a search warrant, the government entity is required to show that there's probable cause for belief that the person who's the subject of the personal identifying information has committed or is committing or is about to commit a criminal offense. And there is a definition on lines 2.24 to 2.35, and also on 3.1, 3.2 about what constitutes personal identifying information. Basically, the definition provides that personal identifying information includes a person's identity, things like their address, telephone numbers that they've called or that have called them, web browsing history, billing records, physical location, and other types of data that a person that might be able to be accessed from various providers of services, including data that's collected by third-party entities such as like cell phone providers or internet providers. There is an exception on lines 3.11 through 3.18 for an allowance for government entities to obtain location information on an electronic device without a warrant. So this would be like obtaining information on the location of a person's cell phone. They can do this without a warrant if the device is reported lost or stolen, if the person has requested emergency services, or if the user of the device has provided informed affirmative consent for disclosure of that information. Government entities also allowed to gain access to personal identifying information about a person if they have provided otherwise have provided informed affirmative consent, or if there's a potential life-threatening situation related to the subject of that information. If a government entity has secured a search warrant and has collected data on a person, they're required to give notice. So this is the language in Subdivision 3. So if you read lines 3.23 through the end of page 3, this is the notice provision. The government entity is required to provide a notice within 3 days of collecting the information. The notice has to include the nature of the law enforcement inquiry, the type of information that was obtained, and if the information was obtained from a third party, they need to disclose the identity of the provider of the information. And they also need to disclose circumstances where a notice is delayed beyond the three-day allowance. And that delay provision is actually on page 4. So this is paragraph C, lines 4.1 through 4.7. This is a procedure that allows a government entity to request a delay in the three-day notice to 10 days. And this allowance needs to be approved by the court. And the government entity needs to show that there is reason to believe that the notification would have an adverse result. And the phrase adverse result is defined on page 2, and it includes situations where notifying a person about the existence of a search warrant would be or would result in the danger to the life or physical safety of someone, a flight from prosecution, evidence tampering or intimidation of witnesses, or would otherwise provide or create a serious jeopardy to an investigation or undue delay of a trial. Government entities also allowed to include in a warrant request a court order directing a third party, which is providing the data, to not notify the person who is the subject of the data of the warrant for a period of up to 10 days. Lines 4.18 through 4.26 are data retention provisions. This language allows the government entity to keep personal identifying information for up to 60 days, and they're allowed to seek a court order extending the 60-day period if it's determined that the extension is necessary to avoid serious jeopardy to investigation or undue delay of a trial. And if the court grants the extension, they're required to specify the full duration of the extension. Unless an extension is granted, the government unit is required to destroy all personal identifying information within the 60-day time period. Subdivision 7 on line 4.32 to 4.35 prohibits a government entity from sharing personal identifying information with another government entity. This includes sharing with federal, state, or local government authorities unless a search warrant has been obtained for that sharing. And Subdivision 8, lines 5.1 through 5.9, prohibits evidence that is obtained in violation of these search warrant requirements from being admissible in any action, proceeding, or hearing, with the exception of proceedings related to the failure of a person to comply with the law, and with the exception of evidence that's obtained by a lawfully executed search warrant issued by a federal court under federal law. And Section 5 repeals some existing language, and this goes along with Section 1 and Section 2. These are, I wouldn't really call them technical changes, but they're sort of conforming changes that repeal language related to current procedures for obtaining electronic data from certain service providers. And that's existing in current law, and it's being repealed or amended to conform to the new policies that are proposed in Section 3 of the bill.
Any questions for Mr. Gearing or Chair Lesh, given you were the House author of the bill? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When they're giving all the list of personal identifying information, I don't see one's image in there. So if it's captured by camera, it's clearly, clearly it's your face that is captured on camera in a surveillance setting. Should that not maybe be included in that? And just my thought. I mean, we're kind of talking about this subject.
Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So image is not specified in the definition, although I think a person probably can make the argument that a photograph or an image fits within the kind of blanket language there where it says it includes information concerning or that reasonably could be construed as concerning the person's identity.
Okay. All right. Chair Lesh.
So currently, and this is changing in law enforcement, currently our ability to identify people comes down to two things, at least in the courts. It's your name and date of birth. If it's your name and date of birth, that's who you are. If we need further identifying clarification, we'll do fingerprint, etc. But we're quickly moving to a situation where I expect that, as you stated, your image will be a part of a biometric that identifies you, because there, you take, for example, immigrants from Somalia, many of them, their birthday is all January 1st. Because so if you have anyone that has the same name, it becomes really difficult. And so they use different methods to do identification processes in different communities. And I think you're correct. I would have assumed that because of that principle that image is part of identifying information, but maybe it is worth clarification.
Senator Limmer.
I'd like the committee to look at line 3.19. And I just needed a little clarification. There it says, and this is one of the factors where a government entity would not need to have a search warrant based on a factor that exists, or that a life-threatening situation would trigger the need for identification. What would happen if someone considered if you knew of a threat that someone was going to commit an act against another person, is that a criminal action? And would that cause the need for a warrant, which is found in lines 3.4 down to 3.10? I could see where it could be both. One would be a criminal a cause for a criminal search warrant, and at the very same time, it may be of an expedient nature that you're trying to prevent harm to someone. Are we requiring a search warrant in that situation, or do we allow the law enforcement to take a pass on the search warrant and spring into action on the cause that it's a potential life-threatening situation? Or a drug deal that might be going down that... I suppose any drug deal is a potential life-threatening situation. I would think that we would want to give some clarification if the court was going to consider this question sometime in the future.
And Senator Limmer, it appears that this Senate file did not get a hearing in the judiciary in 2014. So, again, I think it is the intent of Senator Peterson to reintroduce this. Maybe if you have time to share your concerns with him, maybe he could address that prior to and do a redrafting prior to turning or submitting it for a bill number next year. But I don't know that anybody has an answer to that question here at the table today. Unless,
well, Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
just as background for me. How easy or how difficult, or what would be the time factor in law enforcement getting a search warrant over a telephone from a judge? Does that take a lot of time? Is it just a simple phone call? I don't know. I'm not.
Chair Lesh.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I know Ramsey kind of example. I think most counties operate this way. We have a signing judge, and when it's after hours, there is an on-call signing judge. Whether it's on the weekends or Sunday, the cops will go out to the judge's house and have them sign it. So there is always a judge available.
Madam Senator Chair, Limmer. In the case of a potential life-threatening situation, something that require that traveling to a judge's house would take too long, I believe law enforcement can request a search warrant in a different manner than physical appearing before a judge. And what would be the process on that?
Well, Senator Limmer, if there exists a potentially life-threatening situation, the bill language, as I read it, you would not need a warrant.
Yeah. But in the two circumstances that I outlined, the hypotheticals, which are very real in today's world, I just wanted to know, just for direction, what do you do? If it's a life-threatening situation caused by a potential criminal activity, does it fall into lines 3.4 to 3.10, or does it fall into the exception language that's found on lines 3.11 down to at least 3.19 at least?
No,
which way?
We need. Yeah, given Senator Peterson's not here today, I'm thinking that this is something that could probably be finessed
Sure.
As you move forward and have committee hearings, et cetera. But I think it's an important point to get clarified. All right, any additional questions or comments on the Senate file? Anybody in the audience like to testify on Senate file 2789? Chair Lesh.
So just, and Senator Peterson approached me about this last session, and the reason why I think this is really important to get ahead of the other, all the subsequent technology has been discussed. You know, right now we're doing this piecemeal. We're doing LPR, and we're doing Stingray and Kingfish, and we're doing body cameras, and next we'll be doing facial recognition. We may do something completely different. We already have a microphone set up in cities that can determine the location of a gunshot. How difficult would it be to set up audio devices on corners to determine the intonation of a voice to determine individual to it? I really don't want to be doing this every single year. And I think Senator Peterson's bill does that. It also is prescriptive. And I think the prescription in the bill is important because the business of policing, I should say the profession of policing, has been altered radically over the course of the time since our Constitution was written. And it's an incredibly tough job. But at the same time, in order to alleviate some of the toughness, we've seen an increasing militarization style of police. Because as in past days, when you had a constable walking around and he knew the people or she knew the people who were policed, that is much less so. And so I am seeing tactics bleed into what we're being told are routine practices of policing, which I am taught are military tactics in my role as an infantryman. And I also see the same bleeding into when we're deployed overseas, that fighters are expected to suddenly become police. And that always ends poorly because we're not trained to be police. We're not trained to collect evidence. And so I think that this bill is important because it reasserts the role of police and how we can be successful in the role of policing. At the same time, I am sure that it will be explained to me why some of these things, the current tactics, are necessary. But I think Senator Peterson's bill is excellent at fleshing that out, because if we don't have the conversation about this bill, this just continues to snowball, both the technology and the practices. So even though he's sick, I hope he gets better. We can have further conversations about this, Madam Chair.
All right. Any additional questions or comments? All right. Just a housekeeping matter. If you have things that I do in my safe, bring your safe folder with you. We don't have staff to run around and deliver these things to your office, so whatever's left in your folder will be destroyed. It's been a pleasure serving as your chair, and I wish you great luck. I'll be watching from the armchair, and I have great confidence in the ability of especially this body here to move these issues forward and give them the attention they deserve. Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I was always jealous of Representative Hornstein because he got to work with you on, you know, getting folks up and down the 35W corridor, so I'm glad that I got to find something to work with you on. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
And appreciate all of your work over many years on this and many other subjects. I hope you're not going to be totally in an armchair. You know, we do have positions for former legislators on this commission.
We have a L.A. position open. We don't recognize the experience in the House in our hiring practices. So you have to start where everyone else does.
And if you do just watch us from an armchair, you'll be a bigger data dork than Rich Neumeister. We want you down here helping us work through